we'll see where the episode takes us, like usual.
Sounds good. I'm going to organize this real quick so that it makes some more sense to it.
All right. I'll just be talking at you for a little bit. And then... All right. What's up, Strud? No, you're good.
What up?
Welcome back to another episode of Ball Out. We are going to be discussing today a little bit of what a dream tournament will look like. We're going to be looking at it from all different angles, and we're not really sure if this is going to be a single episode or if we're going to be breaking this down into parts yet. So we're going to see how many rabbit holes we find today and then see what we have to cover in the next episode.
Yeah, that's it. It sounds like a great topic. But I had an idea, but then Brett expanded on it and made it so much better. So I appreciate Brett for taking my idea and then making it better.
I do what I can. I don't want to take too much credit for that, but
that's fair.
But before we get into that, I wanted to kind of touch on a couple of current event things. Okay. I don't know if Caleb, how big of a football fan you are, but did either of you guys watch the Super Bowl?
No,
I'm pissed.
What do you mean? What did you do, Miles?
Oh, I didn't do anything. It's more, I'm just mad because, like, just how that game ended and, like, or not how the game ended, just how the whole game went. I'm just disappointed for, like, a variety of reasons, but it's just like, I'm upset.
Caleb, did it shake out how you thought it was going to shake out? Were you rooting for anybody? What were you thinking?
I definitely thought it was going to be closer. I definitely thought it was going to be more of a game. Up here in Mount Pleasant, we didn't care because both teams have former Chippewas. So
right.
I was just really hoping for a good game. But I'm not upset that the winner won.
Yeah, I saw Big Fish, Eric Fisher, the starting left tackle of Kansas City, posted something on Tuesday, and I don't know if I just said it or not. I totally just spaced out. He is a Chippewa. He was taken number one overall by Kansas City like 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even six now.
It
I don't
was
know.
2013.
2013, Jesus, yeah. So 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow, it's been that long since I've been in college. Holy shit.
Yeah, that
but was anyway. Anyway. I saw him post something on Facebook about not being able to play, and I thought that was going to be trouble for Kansas City. But I did want to see a game. I didn't really have anybody I was rooting for, but did you guys put any money on the game?
No.
I didn't.
I'm glad I didn't.
Well, I did, and I lost it all.
Dang, man. How much did you put in?
I put probably 50 total. But everything was contingent on going over like 56 points, which if Kansas City would have thrown one touchdown, I would have been okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would have been a whole different game. I mean, like, so like I was rooting for Kansas City and I mean, obviously, but like, it was like for a variety. I'm mad because like, so I don't like being a Tom Brady hater, but at the same time I am. Like, not because like typical reading, but he's just like, when you look at him as like an athlete, it just doesn't make sense on how like he's the greatest quarterback ever. But when you look at him as like purely an athlete, he just doesn't fit the quota, and that just does that mind boggles me so much that it actually makes me mad. Because like if you see in his combine like results, it's just I mean, when it comes down like physical results, when it comes down to quickness, I don't know if quarterback do agility, but like when it comes to speed, like all those things that make it like a football player, he has none of it. And that's what makes me so mad. But like aside from that, it's also like that's his seventh ring. Like I'm getting kind of old now. I'm just like, bruh, retire, go away. and the other part was like the whole like baby goat versus I guess original goat. Like I wanted Mahomes to kind of like take the mantle, like take the new reins and just kind of take out Brady and let him do his thing. And that's kind of why I'm a little upset because like it's all those things compiled into one and none of it went the way I was.
Yeah. See, in the middle of the game, I was talking to the Gamecocks and I sent a message to the group that said, you know, I'm glad Brady's doing it on his own just because that solidifies him as like one of the best ever. And there, it ends kind of the Belichick Brady debate, like who was the actual mastermind, whatever. But I sent a message to the Gamecocks. I was like, I'm happy for him, but I'm very upset that Kevin Bailey is such a huge Tom Brady fan that he's probably ecstatic right now. And knowing that he's this happy makes me sad.
Yeah. We can't have Kevin happy.
No. And I did text him yesterday about it. And he agreed that that was a fair point. Like I was right to feel that way throughout the game. So I did get the okay. So I felt better about it.
Yeah. I mean, at least he's justified now.
Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to, you know, touch base on a little bit of current events. And then I wanted to bring up something that we had talked about as far as, I don't even remember why we brought it up, but I had brought up getting a testosterone test and see where my levels were at. So I'm finally actually doing it tomorrow. It's been sitting in my dresser drawer since December. And finally getting around to it because my schedule is kind of back to something normal. I'm not, you know, staying up late working on the house or whatever. I've got a decent sleep schedule, so I'm going to get kind of a good baseline reading here. And the reason why it like kind of kicked in for me doing it today was I was doing some research for a client who happens to be a dodgeball player, but I didn't really talk to him if he wants to be disclosed or not, so I won't bring up his name, but he was talking about managing stress, and I was doing research and found ashwagandha. You ever heard of it?
Sounds familiar. I can't remember why though.
So it's, and I, Caleb, I'll have to have you check this, but I believe it's from Africa. It's a root extract.
Yeah, and that is what it is. And I remember why I know it. That's why.
Okay. And so I think it's in the like adaptogen family where it's kind of cortisol reducing, which, you know, in turn boosts your mood. It lowers your stress hormone. But it has some, and it's a special derivative of it. It's like KW22 or something. I posted it on my Instagram today, but. So one of the other side effects of reducing cortisol is a bump in your testosterone because they have an inverse relationship. So I wanted to get a baseline out today, and then I want to start taking this ashwagandha tomorrow and see how it affects my levels and see if this is like actual science or to see if this is kind of like hippie stuff. I don't know. I feel like it's just, it's a root. So I feel like that's in that realm. So I'm going to do a little bit of guinea pigging on myself.
I mean, I feel like anything that comes out of the ground is more likely to be backed by science versus like chemical compounds. I mean, chemical compounds usually are designed to do what they are doing, but at the same time, like natural, I guess, organics or natural like elements typically are better for the body because, again, it comes from nature. It's not like it's manufactured, not like it's chemically produced, so it's better that it comes from the ground versus like chemically induced whatever it is.
Yeah, and it got a lot of high praises, so I figured, you know, I've always been the kind of person to, before I recommend something, I want to try something out. And because he was looking for stress relief, like anxiety lowering stuff, that I wanted to try it out myself first, even though I'm not an anxious person in like the least bit. And I don't get stressed out easily. So if my stress drops even lower, I might just be a vegetable, but at least then I'll know.
That's fair. I mean, I think you stress yourself out enough when it comes to like workouts because that stresses your body. So I think that evens it out.
That's true. And my caffeine intake is ridiculous. Ooh. So
yeah, I thought you fixed that, but never mind.
No, I was actually, so touching on that, I had actually thought about if I should do a whole month of a caffeine cleanse just to do it. And I know the first like week and a half it'll be terrible, but then it's really sad to think that that first dose of pre-workout back in April will just feel so good. Then that's really the drive for it.
You should have started in February, where it's the shortest month. You don't have to think about it as much, but too late now.
Yeah, you know, I thought about it, but I was like, it's already, what's that, the ninth day.
Yeah,
I can't do it now. So yeah. March, somebody remind me in March, and we'll make an announcement then.
Sounds good. All right, I got one more rabbit hole before we dive into our episode. So, you know, I brought up the ROMWAD app a couple months ago, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been doing that for like consistently since like January, maybe even December. And I've been focusing on the shoulder pad. Oh my gosh, man, it's done so many wonders. Like, I haven't done any like shoulder mobility like since I like dislocated my shoulder back in like 2017, 2018, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And like I had pretty good range of motion before that, but like once I started doing like the ROMWAD pads for the shoulders, like I didn't realize how tight that area was. Like, you know how you can like the saddle, I think archer, where you have to grab your hand from behind your back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a hard time doing that before. And I mean, it's still kind of rough now, but I'm able to get a full on lockdown grip and be able to relax in that position versus like before, like I could barely get my finger to touch and maybe like kind of interlock one finger in with each other. But now it's like, it's doing wonders. I'm on the explosive athlete one now where it's working on my hips, pretty much working on your whole body, and I'm in love with it. So I'm gonna recommend it to everybody again. Like, I've been telling everyone at my job, all the members at my gym, like, hey, check this app out. Yes, you gotta pay for it, but it's definitely worth the money if you do it like even two or three times a week. Like, honestly, if you do it once a week, that's actually worth the money either way, because most yoga classes are gonna be more than $15 per class. So
When do you find yourself doing it? Like during the day? Are you like wake up in the morning and doing it? Are you doing it before bed? Or
I do it right after my workout. So it really depends on the day. Like some days I'll do the workouts in the morning and then do it right afterwards, or I'll do it in the afternoon, or I'll do it in the middle of the day. Today I was supposed to do it earlier, but I might have to do it after this podcast. But that I try not to do it at home, because then I get distracted too much and then don't end up doing it. But yeah, like I usually try. So one thing I would recommend for people though is you warm up for these. A lot of people tend to just go into it. I know I went into one of them without warming up, and it wasn't as comfortable because they really want you to relax in these stretches. But if you're tight, you're tense, and you kind of just jump into it without really loosening up, you're gonna not get the full benefits of the stretches, and you're also gonna be kind of resisting it because you won't be able to fully. They call it surrendering, where you completely relax. You won't be able to do that if you're tight.
Yeah, and when I was starting it, that's how I felt. I was fighting it a lot, even though I wanted to push myself to further like get into the stretch. I was actually doing more harm than good, because then I'm tensing up, I'm not relaxing. So, yeah, that was something I need to start doing. And the big thing was for me though was trying to find a spot in my schedule that I could do it consistently. So like linking it up with a workout is a great way to do it. For me, it was hard because I mean my gym's in the garage. It's freezing out there.
Yeah.
So if I slow down and start to do a stretch, it's cold, I get tight. But then I want to come inside afterwards, and then afterwards I'm in the house and I want to relax. So I'm going to have to find either before bed or in the morning, wake up, you know, 15 minutes earlier and try to do a quick stretch. That's what I might have to do, because I definitely haven't gotten my money's worth the last month.
Yeah, so. That's usually what I recommended to people. Like, if they can't figure out their schedule, just do it right before they go to bed. Or if they wake up in the morning, like, move around before they start it, because you don't want to roll out of bed and start doing that. But I would say in your case, like, if you're already in your garage and you're, like, pretty much fighting the cold, you're already warm for the most part. So just, literally just run inside your house, find a spot, and just start it right then and there while you're still warm versus trying to relax it. And because usually when you do your workout, you kind of want to relax afterwards. I know the feeling, but like that's actually like the best like kind of mental space you could be in when you're doing the ROMWAD, because then you're not really thinking about it. You're kind of just like, you're just in kind of the zen mode at that point.
Yeah, but then as soon as I come in the house, you know, it's I got three people that need things from me.
Oh yeah,
because I've been out in the garage for, you know, an hour, and that had my Brett time to get after my workout. And then when I come inside, it's like, oh hey, you know, remember that thing we were talking about beforehand? And I'm like, no, I don't. I don't remember. So
that's fair.
Yeah, little people need a lot of things from you a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's go ahead and get into this episode. We went on a real far rabbit hole.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess we can just go ahead and start. So how do we want to start? Like, we want to start off with like our dream dodgeball tournament, or like a ball out version, or like how do you want to start this?
All right, so let's kind of preface this a little bit. We're definitely gonna have to do this in two parts now, but let's try to break down, instead of like what we like a dream would be as a player, let's first break down.
You want to go into like categories and then kind of just like go off of that, because I feel like categories will be the easiest way to go. Like for example, if you want to pick a specific ball type or tournament, it'd be a lot easier versus kind of do like the whole thing all wrapped up in a brief.
Well, see, that's the thing I was thinking is if it's gonna be like the ideal, and I'm using air quotes, setup, I would think that, you know, each ball type kind of has its own mini season. So I would think that it's all kind of structured similarly, just, you know, spread out throughout the year. So that's why I'm thinking, do we want to talk about how we see like dodgeball being set up for the most success, and how we want to see like the future of dodgeball looking? Or do we want to talk about, as a player, what would be our dream tournament?
So, okay, so normally we have a list of everything. So like, if you go to the list I showed you before, I have that as an option for like ideal players episode. Mm-hmm. Of this. So I feel like we can have that as like a separate episode. So I feel like whatever you said for the first one, where like we talk about like what will be best for dodgeball, I think we could start with that one and then kind of work our way off of that one. And then,
okay.
Like I said, we're probably gonna have to break this up into like, I don't know, I think two is still too few. I feel like we end up getting like three or four, which is fine. Like, I'm totally down to do more of these. So what was that first option again? I forgot what the first one you said was.
So in an ideal world, like dodgeball's popular and, you know, it's thriving. We've hit a stride and we're starting to get like high level athletes. Well, we do get some high level athletes, but like we're getting like high caliber dodgeball. What does a dodgeball tournament look like 10 years down the road with that continued growth?
Gotcha. Okay. So, dang, I don't even know where to start for this.
Well, we'll just start with, okay, so if we're looking at, we'll look at a nationals tournament. What does a nationals tournament look like for, we'll just do an 8.5 open for our kind of generalized tournament here.
Okay, so I would say, well, let's just keep the court sizes like the same, because there's no way we're getting an argument about court sizes for 8.5. So let's say typical 8.5, I think it's like 50 feet long, 25 feet wide with a 25 foot throw line and 20 foot neutral line. So I would say when it comes to like a nationals tournament, I don't think it would be run the way we currently run it.
I don't either.
It would definitely not be like a 2 or 3 day event. It would probably be maybe like at most a week. Like, I think it would be, if you want to get to like an actual like professional level, there's no way they would cram 12 hours of dodgeball into one day. Like, there's just no way that would happen. Because one, I'm assuming there'd be more teams. Mm-hmm. Two, it would have to be like spread out. Like, I would say round robin probably spread out for 2 days. And then the bracket play would probably be, depending on how many teams are there, it'd probably be broken up into another 2 days, and the finals would be on the fifth day. So that'd be my guess.
Wow. I was thinking more of how like the NCDA has it set up, where it's because we are talking about one style of play,
yeah,
for this tournament, that they would do round robin one day where you play maybe a few, I don't know, break up into pools like they do, in the NCAA and in Premier, but break up into pools, maybe do a little bit larger, maybe play like, I don't know, 8 to 10 games, because those would be the only games that you're playing that day. You're not waiting for, you know, Nosting to start or Pinch to start. So those will be your only games for the day. So you could even get there around noon and be out by like 6.
Yeah. Would it be a Nationals strictly 0.8, 0.5, or would they still be multiple divisions? Because I think that would be a separate conversation as well.
Well, I would say that it is strictly 8.5 open, and there would be women's, co-ed, and men's. So,
oh, okay. So all those three. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So you could break that. You could, you know, spread that out throughout the day. That it just the round robin play takes, you know, the whole day, mm-hmm. and then you can get out a little bit early. Make sure that you have time to kind of recover before tomorrow. And I think it would almost be more beneficial to make sure that each team has 8 players just to cover those bases, to make sure that if anything happens that, you know, you're ready to play. If, you know, if I go ahead. No, I was just going to say that. So you have one person, you know, one person goes out, you're still able to sub in and stay as fresh as possible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say if we're at the professional level, I don't think there's any way that the games, especially if it's that many teams, there's no way that they're not going to do timed events. Because, like, I know the USA board is starting to move toward timed events just because it makes scheduling a lot easier. It makes the tournament run smoother. There are no delays. You don't have, like you say, you don't have to wait on teams to finish their games or start, get there on time. There's none of that going on. Everything's on the schedule. So I feel like when it comes down to time game, depending on how long the games are, you might need more than 8 players. Especially if you do WDBF, they have 12 people. Now, granted, for one game, you're not going to need 12 guys, but when it comes to over a course of certain days, they definitely needed all 12 guys. So I think, especially with 8.5, like you know the feeling after an elite tournament, like 8.5, you're sore for like your entire body is wrecked the whole day.
Oh yeah,
I mean that. I think that a large part of that has to do with the 12-hour like time frame that you're crushing everything into. But at the same time, like it does take a toll because it's a heavier ball and uses more muscles in order to get that ball down the to the other side of the court, and it's going to take a lot more toll on your body. Now, granted, foam and Loewenstein have a lot more torque, so it does a little bit more damage, but I would say in terms of just overall muscle usage, 8.5 using more. So that will take a larger toll on your body, so you're going to need, I would say short of 10. Like, I would say maybe 10, depending. It depends on the format of the tournament, but I would say you probably need a roster of 10, maybe 2 backups and then 8 like starting guys and then 2 rigid alternates just in case anything does happen.
Yeah, but see, that's what I'm saying is, though, like if in this ideal tournament, though, time isn't an issue because we're not in a rented space to that we need to be out at a certain time. You know, like this is a, maybe it's even a ball out facility, I don't know, but it's something that's, you know, it's dedicated for dodgeball, and like that's what it's here for, and we're here until it ends. It's like a tennis match, like that, those ones that go for like 4 hours until they break or whatever, they have nowhere to be. This is just the event and we're here for that. So when I say bringing 8 players, that's, you know, what I envision is that we're not rushing people around courts. You know, we have maybe, say we have 4 pools, one for each region, but even though they would be all mixed up, 4 just sound like a good number. Maybe you even have one pool come in from, I don't know, 8 to 12 and then 12 to 4 or whatever the time frame would be. Mm-hmm. And you just have those pools playing, and you can go and hang out at the gym all day if you want to see where you set up or where you're falling, but time is not an issue here, is I guess the greater point I'm trying to get at. Mm-hmm. So if all that forms on the first day and then it's all bracket on the second day. What are we looking at as far as, let's even break this down to like city, like where is this ideally held?
I mean, it's probably gonna be happening in, actually, I don't know. I mean, I would want to say that like any national level tournament is going to be happening at a larger city. So like, it's gotta be like your Chicago, your New York, your Texas, like not Texas, but like Houston, Austin, like Texas, cities. Los Angeles is probably be one of the higher sought out ones because there's so much dodgeball there. So accessibility is gonna be a big thing over there. But I feel like a large part of the reason why we do, at least I would say currently we do our tournaments in larger cities is because one, it's able to get people in and out. It's a lot easier for airports to have. Two, I think a lot of it has to do with like the surrounding area. Like a lot of people go out party, they go out see the sights, they go out and do all these things. When you're a professional athlete, you don't need to do all that. I mean, most of them don't do that, so either they win or they're done. So they don't go out the night of and go out to drink. They don't go out the night of spend the whole day going out to amusement parks or whatever they're doing. They may do that like before the event and after, but they're not going to do it while, especially if it's a multi day tournament, they're not going to be doing that during the tournament. They'll be doing it before or after. So I think that's why a reason why we currently have the larger cities, or at least with cities that have things to do around it, is because people are paying to go, so they want to make it as enjoyable experience as possible within the tournament and outside the experience tournament. But when it comes to like this tournament, I mean, I would say it would still probably be in the bigger cities, but it probably wouldn't have to be like as enforced as it needs to be now, if that makes sense.
What do you mean enforced? Like,
so like we put a second priority on the bigger cities now, but if you're doing a world championship, you could build a stadium wherever you want, and it doesn't even have to be a big city. Like it could be, I don't know, like we said before, in like Tennessee or something.
True.
So that, while we have the facility and people to show up to, we don't have to have it in a major city.
Yeah, if the infrastructure is there to, I mean, see, that's the only thing is, do you want people, like, say it's in Nashville, like, if you go to like the Stanley Cup Finals that are in Nashville, you know, the whole city's out, you know, bars are going crazy, and it spreads more of a word of mouth, like, you know, somebody that's maybe just visiting for, I don't know, work or something, that's stumbling around town, gets a little bit more confused. It's like, why? What is going on here? Like the amount of kind of running into dodgeball is increased, but if dodgeball is global and we're getting good, you know, TV coverage, where, you know, social media is, we have a bunch of engagement, bunch of followers, like we're talking millions. Then you're right. It could totally just be in the middle of Montana with three hotels and four restaurants, and we'd be fine. Exactly. But I think being able to get into a big city, like a Chicago, New York, because I mean New York and LA are the two biggest broadcast centers, sports markets. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, sports markets.
Yeah, you're right.
So, I mean, obviously, those two would be ideal because of just the population density, and it would get cycled around town. Like, hey, did you know that there's a dodgeball national tournament here this weekend? Like, should we go down and check it out? It just ups those, you know, those growth factors.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Like, it's like pretty much like this entire conversation. It's all hypothetical. It's all situational based on what we determine will probably be needed, and then that's going to determine the next talking point. So I think it really depends on how it all gets envisioned at this point.
Mm-hmm. So now here's our next big hurdle. So we have fans. Where do they sit? How do we keep fans safe from, you know, catching a cross to the face? And how do we make sure that we have, you know, dodgeballs in our court? And I think Dom brought it up. And how do we make sure that they're not getting balls in other courts and stopping their play and potentially disrupting their rhythm?
So this is the toughest one because, like, it depends. Like, if we're doing a tournament and there's multiple courts happening, so, like, here's I think the biggest question is, like, how would the dodgeball court be set up? Because if we're doing tournaments, kind of how, like, we're doing where we have multiple courts, there's no way you're going to get enough fans to surround all those courts unless you have a, like, I'm talking about a giant stadium. Because, like, if you look at a basketball court, it's just one court, billions of fans around the whole court. And that should be one court. Now, would we do that for just a championship game? Would we do that for each court? Would we do, like, a bigger center with multiple courts in the center and then can narrow it down to one big court? And as the tournament goes on, we increase the seating space as we decrease the amount of courts. Like, I feel like there's a lot of different scenarios you could do with that. Mm-hmm. But, like, that's just, like, with a fan seating thing. So, like, that can be kind of adjusted. But when it comes down to keeping the balls in place, my envision, I kind of envisioned, like, a hockey rink, to be honest. Yeah. Like, if you do just, like, one court itself, you have a hockey rink where, because I've actually played in, like, I think we both played in hockey rinks before. And it's very convenient up until you have the sides not working. But if you get specifically, like, size for that one court, like, having a hockey rink would actually probably be the most ideal situation for dodgeball, because even if you throw a ball, like, a mile high, you can have either glass or netting stopping it from going out and about into the fan group. Two, like, it keeps, like, especially, like, when you're playing on tournaments now, where if you end up on the side without a wall, you're on an extreme disadvantage. So all you have to do is throw the ball at the wall, wait till it bounces back. Throw the ball at the wall, mm-hmm. wait till it bounces back. And the team that has the no wall side is screwed. But if you have that on both sides, it's advantage to everybody, and it's basically the best of both worlds.
Yeah. So how much? In my opinion. How much of a buffer zone do you go around the actual, like, field of play? Like, are you looking at maybe 5 feet from back line to the wall, or are you looking more like 10 feet?
I'm thinking closer to 10 feet because, like, let's say, because I know at WDBF this happens periodically, like, let's say a ball ricochets off a player and your teammate or that player that got hit jumps out of bounds, try to, like, push it back, two or three teammates try to catch it. You can't do that with a wall that's 3 feet away from you. At least I know I can't because I'm slamming into that wall every time. So, yeah. Or, like, let's say you have shaggers. Like, if the ball hits the back of the wall, there's no way a shagger's going to be able to stop that ball before it bounces back. So I feel like for the safety of the shaggers, safety of the players, it would have to be a bigger buffer zone. Now, the width won't have to be nearly as big. It could be maybe, like, 6 feet or so because the queue, their players are off the side. As long as there's enough space for the refs, the players on the queue, shaggers to operate freely, like, long if there's enough space for all of that, I feel like it could be anywhere from, like, 6 to 10 feet, and then the back line could be 10 to 12, 15 feet, depending on the shaping of the entire court.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I think, you know, it, like he had said, more of, like, the hockey rink style. Remember, I don't know, I guess, growing up, you remember those, like half pads that were at, like, park hockey rinks? Do you have any of those around you?
I know park. Oh, no, I have no idea what you're talking about.
So, like at a city park or something, they have those, like a rollerblade hockey rink, and they kind of have those pads that, or, like, small walls that only come up to kind of, like, I guess your mid, yeah, like, mid-thigh to hip range. Mm-hmm. And then if you put nets up after that, so that way that does even more for the ricochet, I think that would be ideal. But now that you kind of brought up refs and shaggers, what is your ideal ref setup? Like, how many refs are we having on each side? And having shaggers that aren't your teammates,
yeah,
I think poses challenges, and it's also great.
Well, I feel like you would have to have shaggers that work with your team because, like, the way that the world's tournaments works, like, they have to communicate with shaggers, and you have to, like, practice with the shagger in order to get the timing, get the because, like, every player is gonna want their shagger to do different things. If you have random shaggers, that's gonna make your world a lot harder. So I feel like the shaggers have to be kind of, like, part of the team. So I feel like that is going to be, like, part of your, I guess, quote-unquote roster.
So Shaggers would be like Bat Boys in like basically in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool because then you get then you can kind of that's a bad word. You can kind of keep younger people interested in the game and but hey, do you want to be a Shagger for our team? Come travel with us. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, and they learn from the best. Like I feel like it'd be like up and coming players that don't exactly make the squad, but like have a chance. But like maybe they're like not 18 or whatever, but like they don't make the cutoff or I don't know, like some long lines of that. Like because I know there's a couple of Shaggers from the World's team last year, and they're all pretty good players. They're all, I think they're pretty sure they're all players that have potential to make the team next year. I'm pretty sure it's like Kyle Sanders. No, what's Kyle Sanders? Matt Levine and I cannot remember his name. There's a couple players that helped out with the World's team last year. So I'm pretty sure like they gained a lot of experience because they had to practice with the team. So they learned all the drills. They learned how the team works. So that's only going to help them when they come to combat, whenever the next one is.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. It's kind of like a stepping stone mm-hmm. or you can open it up to more of like a fan type
yeah.
role. All right. So what I can only imagine situation. Yeah, that's what I was going to jump into, but I can only imagine being a listener to this and just screaming at your phone or whatever and wanting us to talk about different stuff, but just everyone that's listening out there, just be patient. We'll get to it, I promise.
Yeah, exactly. And if we don't get to it, respond on our Facebook post, and then we'll get to it on the next one.
Yeah, if there's anything we don't cover, please feel free, shoot us a message, reach out, and let us know where we messed up.
Exactly.
We love that. Right down.
Right, so, yeah. So how many rests are you putting on the court for you?
Jesus. So I'm thinking, let's see.
Let me rephrase. So how many refs you put on the court, and what's the hierarchy of the refs situation?
Well, okay. How are we going to go with – oh, man. It's difficult because will we actually use a clock at that point, or will we still have counters?
I think you need both. I mean, you're going to need a clock for the whole – the thing is – if it's not,
how deep are we going here?
Yeah, the question is if it's a time game or not a time game. Because either way, you're going to need a shot. I feel like you need a shot clock. Like you can't have refs that count because that's unreliable because that can be very inconsistent. So at the professional level, you're going to have a shot clock like any other sport would. So
yeah,
that would get rid of that.
I agree.
If it's a time game, it won't really matter if you have time or not because the shot clock can be consistent either way.
Yeah, I think there needs to be shot clock on both sides. And I do think that the shot clock needs to get jumped up to 15 seconds because I think if you realistically count 10 seconds, that it's a little bit higher because, you know, I think that the pace that we count, that it is a little bit longer than 10 seconds.
Yeah.
I
just want to make a real quick point.
No, go ahead.
I will say that it depends on the rule set because if it's kind of like WDBF, it's from this. I want to say it's from the time that a ball is thrown, the play clock reset. So if a ball is off court, the play clock's still going. If you want to go based off of Elite and maybe USA Dodgeball, I don't know if they have that rule set still, where if a ball makes it to the court, that's when the play start clock resets. So those two drastic play style, or not play style, but the rule sets drastically change the shot clock count. So I feel like play style is another one we'll have to get into later, which that probably could be an episode by itself. But
yeah, well, I think that if there's a ball in play that's able to be thrown, mm-hmm. your shot clock should be going.
So regardless if all of your balls are on the court.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's all. If you have one ball that's on the court that is able to be thrown, your clock should be going.
Oh, okay.
So to bring this full circle back to refs, so I think that there should be, you know, somebody that is on the shot clock, you know, hitting reset every time that ball is thrown. So one for each side. So that's two. There should be a head ref, an assistant ref. So four, two back line judges. And then I think there should
be side or that one side.
Ooh, that's tough. Maybe on. Maybe two on each side in both corners, so that way they can be looking up the sideline as well.
Okay, so we're at eight.
And then I would put I would almost put one more in the middle watching the throw line. Like that, you are the throw line. Like, don't look at anything else. Just watch the throw line on both sides. So that's 10 refs.
Oh, damn. Okay. Hold on. So you got a head ref?
This court is locked down.
Yeah, no, that's so many people. So hold up. So you got a head ref. You got an assistant ref. You got two middle line refs that are watching the line. You got, so that's four people. You got four people on the corner basically watching the lines on the boundaries on the back line and the side.
Back line and the side, yep.
Yeah, and then you got one person on the shot clock and one person doing what again? What was the last one?
Throw line judge.
Isn't that the center line guy? There's two of those already.
Well, that's the head and the assistant. They're,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I want them watching outs. I don't want them watching the throw line because, I mean, that call happens all the time where you're like, I don't know. I was looking at the throw line. I didn't see which ball. So I just want to cut that out.
So I'm probably getting way too ahead of it. But like, let's say we have like a really cool like floor. If anyone steps on the line, it lights up. Like that would make so much sense. It would make things so much easier. So like anytime the line gets touched by anybody, it lights up in that exact spot, or the whole line beeps. I don't know, something like that, where like you don't have to
like
worry
in bowling,
about the lines.
When you like step on the line and it like lights up,
it buzzes. Yeah.
Like either the line itself buzzes, or like the whole anchor sound or something. I don't know, something that like makes it clear that someone stepped in the line. That one, that would save refs like energy of looking at the line. So that would actually drastically reduce the number of line refs you need. Like, I feel like you still probably need the same amount of refs to get different angles, but you wouldn't have to like have that ref look at the ground and try to look at the play that's happening right in front of them at the same time. Especially for those backline refs, like sometimes when someone just flies by them, they're looking at the line just in case someone's like trying to dodge and hit the line. But also, if something happens, their attention's fully focused on what's happening in front of them versus half on the line, half on them as well.
Yeah, and I guess if we are talking about, you know, perfect world, then might as well go all out and have buzzing light up floors also.
Exactly.
Then you have less traffic around the court too, so.
Exactly. Like, I feel like you'd still need refs in the same spots. Like, I feel like you'd still probably need two. I would say I feel like you need a ref on every corner. So like all four corners of the court, you'll need at least one ref. Mm-hmm. And you'll probably still need two center line refs.
Yeah, the head and the assistant.
Mm-hmm, because like one of them will start it, the other one will assist. And then the head ref makes the final decisions, but the assistant ref can, I don't want to say overrule
a line judge.
Yeah, I guess. Like, I don't want to say he can overrule it, but like at the same time, like if he's got a better angle at it, he has the potential to like make a call. Like, hey, I definitely saw something. Like the head ref is kind of like, I don't want to say a figurative leader, but like at the same time, like he does make the final call. It is close, and no one can like make the tiebreaker. Like what happened, but if the assistant ref is like, I guess confident enough, I feel like he can make a final call. Just depending on the situation, because like we all know like there are times where like you think you see something, but then another ref like who probably had a better angle on it is very confident in their call. We're gonna let them get that call usually.
Well, let's throw this wrench into it. If it's getting that into it, at what point are we getting replay booths and getting challenges? And
yeah, I was thinking about that too.
When, how many times can a ref go underneath the hood and check out a, if somebody was hit or if it like hit the ground?
Dude, that's a whole other like, episode by itself, but let's get into it just a little bit. So here's my opinion on that. So like, I actually thought about like having replays, having refs, challenges and all that. So I feel like it'd be like kind of similar to football where like, here's how football's flags and challenges and everything works. So if a team uses the challenge card, and their play that they're challenging gets overturned, that's fine. But if it doesn't get overturned, they lose a timeout. But that only applies if this game has a timeout or has ability to get timeout because it's not a time game. So let's operate under the assumption that this is a time game. So I feel like the rules should be very similar to football, where like if you are challenging a play and it doesn't get overturned, you should lose a timeout. And you lose that challenge. But if it does get overturned, you keep your timeouts and then you get the play worked out in your favor. Now, the number of times the refs can go, I feel like, that's a good question. That's hard.
Like, see, I think it should be like in the NFL where, you know, refs can do it. They can make the call, you know, where it's under 2 minutes in a half or in the game. Mm-hmm. I think that if, you know, there's two people left and there's a close call and like, say there's four on one side, two on the other side, and there's a very like controversial out on the side that has two, mm-hmm. that ref is allowed to go underneath, like under the hood, so to speak, and check that play out just because that's such a huge swing to go down 4-2 and then to go to 4-1.
Yes. And I definitely agree. I would say another thing you could probably do is like, there are times where like refs are like, it's like a 50-50 split. You have no idea like what the right call is. I feel like that situation, you would have to look at the replays, because there's just no way you're going to make a call, because one way could sway you the other and it can make a very big difference in the game. So I feel like if refs are 50-50 split, they should be able to look at the replay as an option, or just to kind of like solidify their call just in case.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get back to more of the play style, because I think if we go too far into that, we'll be here the rest of the night.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a fun topic to have with, like, I don't know, like officiating or not officiating crews. But actually, yeah, I feel like we should have like people that are refs like on the higher level stages definitely come in on this one of those episodes and talk about it. But that's another story for another time. Well,
it'll be great if they aren't other players and they're people that have been like studying the rule book and have like watched film and have gone through like a reffing actual course. That would be awesome.
Like, I know for the world's teams, the a lot of those refs have to go through tests, and there's like a player, there's a refing committee in order to be a ref on their on the world stage. So there's like a whole committee about how like they could develop as refs, how to get better every year. So there's a whole thing for that. I feel like we should get one of those guys on here, but I don't know who they are. But that's a problem for another day, though.
Actually, never mind. We'll talk about that off air. I don't want to derail us too much on this.
Yeah.
Let's talk about one more thing, and then we'll have to probably jump into a part two. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about, let's say it's, you know, coming down to the final game in this fake scenario of Worlds or a Nationals tournament. How are we going to be able to record these games and stream them?
That's going to be the hardest part, especially if we're confined inside a hockey rink, because as we all know with hockey, in hockey, you're following a puck, and the puck is the tiniest thing ever. But because no one really knows how to film dodgeball, it's going to be hard. Like, I feel like the best angle you can get for it is kind of like a, not a bird's eye view, but like you're basically following one team from behind. So basically you're standing on one side of the court and looking at the backs of one players and the fronts of another players, mm-hmm. the opposing teams. And you'll have to get two camera angles on either side. You're probably going to need two on the, you're probably going to need one camera on all sides of the court for sure.
Well, Caleb, you're into like broadcasting and stuff. Let's hear your take on this. How would you, in a perfect world, set up to record something like this?
In a perfect world, and this is what like I do at Central for like college basketball. So we have six cameras, and I think it works. So you have two cameras that are sort of bird's eye view, like Miles was talking about, and one's just following the game, and they keep the whole court in their shot. And then the second camera up there is almost like to get reactions, because I feel like you run cameras for two reasons, and it's for like the actions, and the other side is for reviewing. So that's mm-hmm. why you have that first camera that can like, it has the whole court, and then the second camera can be like a reaction shot. Mm-hmm. And then like Miles was talking about, putting two cameras on the court on each side, so you get the backs of one, which those probably would be hard early if there's a lot of players, but like once there's down to like one or two players left, I think that'd be really cool.
Easy to track.
Yeah. And then you add like the other one that I would add is like a wireless one. So like that's kind of cool for like timeouts and stuff. Like you can get the camera right there and like see what they're talking about or stuff like that. I think that would be a pretty good setup. And then there's always like other like more fun cameras that you could play around with, but I think those five are like the essential ones.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. And I imagine like, so this is what my brain comes up with. Like, you know, like big security cameras that are in like parking lots and stuff? Like yes. Big white bricks looking ones. I imagine like two of those in the middle, just always filming like the front view of each side. And then kind of what you're talking about, Caleb, where you kind of have a swing where you can go back and forth and follow the play. And then I do like when you have, you know, something like a wireless camera, where are you having cameramen like on court side? Like, is that?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And you know, like it's for like basketball, it's usually used for like the coaches or like timeouts. But for dodgeball, it could be like almost like the bench, like if there's like a big bench reaction.
Yeah, like those NBA ones that when LeBron's no look three pointer and everybody just falls off their chairs.
Yeah, that was always great. Like I feel like we're gonna need like a ton, like a butt ton of like random cameras everywhere, because like dodgeball, there's so much going on. So like even if it's not in like the live feed, but for like replays or for like those reaction things, like where you wouldn't see that on a camera, you probably wouldn't even see it as a fan, but when you get to zoom in on a random shot, something that you probably wouldn't have seen ever, but because we got it on camera, that'd be great. Like I feel like you would need one on every line, just to like for example, Jeremy Bizzle's like Matrix catch. Like if you got that on a close up from like any angle, that would be amazing to watch. Versus like 30, 40 feet away, and you can't zoom in on it and it's not the greatest quality. So like I feel like dodgeball is one of those sports where you just need a camera literally everywhere. Like you're gonna need it in the back lines, you're gonna need it from bird's eye view, you're gonna need it. I feel like you need like a first person camera where like they're kind of just walking around or like around the court, just in case, like, I don't know, like it's a ball shagger or something, or I don't know, like something where it's like you're moving around, you're getting close up, and it's, I feel like it'd be really cool to have like a kind of first person, not on the court, but like one of those camera guys that kind of gets moving around and they just get really cool shots randomly.
Yeah, like an over the shoulder, like somebody came up to the like throw line and you get kind of see that over the shoulder release and then kind of track the ball. That would be a sweet shot.
Exactly. Especially if a ball's coming at them and they're able to dodge it without it being like the camera's falling over. That'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Caleb, that sounds like a producer's nightmare trying to switch between all these cameras.
Yeah. Especially the sport, giant team. Dodgeball that's so fast paced and there's never really like a stop. Like it's usually like constant.
Yeah. I feel like you would have to stay basically in the full, like the full court shot until it like went down to like 2-on-2 or something. Or if, like we said, there was a big call that you had to kind of show a replay of. And
Like, I feel like this sport, it would be like one of those where like you can't watch it like live. You have to have like delayed by like a minute or two just to give like the producers some time to figure out what would be like the best shot and then like shoot it live from that. So that way it could be a little touched up a little bit. Cause I know whenever anything's live, it's never actually live. It's like 5 or 6 seconds like delayed. But for dodgeball, it probably had to be a little bit more.
Right.
It would probably suck when it comes to like big games, like spoilers and everything, but I feel like it'd be worth it for the production value, especially if you can like release it later, like a couple hours later after it's been touched up and everything. That'd be even better.
Yeah, they did that with the NCAA's last nationals that was at Grand Valley. They released it like, I think it was like a week later or something. Mm-hmm. Like they did it live, but then they like mastered it or like chopped it up and put it all together.
Yeah.
So it was like a full immersive experience, which was cool, but it would have been cooler if it was like a little bit quicker of a turnaround. That way it was like a little bit more relevant.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely agree. And that would definitely be something where you have millions of dollars, you could do it in like in a matter of an hour or whatever. So it'd definitely be doable.
Yeah, we'll just get Caleb on it. He's got it covered.
He has his own production team and everything.
All right, well, before we get too far into a rabbit hole in something else, we're going to have to cut this one, and we'll pick this up in next week's episode. Do we have anything that was kind of tailored towards what we went over in the social media talks?
Or
we kind of cover everything.
We kind of covered everything. I know we only got two main posts. Like, I know Dominic Borgia, he asked about like filming, photography. So I think we got that down for the most part. We can always touch up on that a little bit more if we need to next week. I think he mentioned that we can always have one court for men, one court for women at the same time, and have both those be recorded. We kind of touched on that a little bit earlier about how it would be a men's, women's, and co-ed division. Let's see what else. Nicholas Factorin, actually, I'm going to shout out you, Meg. You gave me the idea of doing multiple series for this one, so I kind of appreciate that on how, like, he was very specific with his question about, like, how we can apply this, like, kind of dodgeball utopia concept to a variety of different things. So that's why, like, if you listen to the episode, like, it's got a lot of different things that we could touch on, because each one topic is a rabbit hole that could be its own episode if we really wanted it to be. So I appreciate Nick for giving us more variety with this conversation versus like being really, really vague in terms of what we could do. And I'm looking forward to our next episode and what else we get into.
Yeah. And if there's anything you really want us to touch on and kind of discuss, or even anything that, you know, you want to interject and be like, hey, Brett, your ass was wrong. You can't be doing that. I want to hear about it. And we'll go over it next week. So make sure to be following us on our Instagram, Facebook, on Twitter, even though Twitter's been a little lackluster. But go ahead, follow all those, and stay up to date on everything we're doing. This episode was fun, Miles. I'm excited for these next couple. And you guys got anything else?
No, I think we're good.
That was a very anticlimactic sign off, but
I mean, hey, this is the first time we've had an episode where we thought it was gonna end in one continue on, so it's okay.
Yeah, we'll pick this up next week, and so I'm good if you're good.
I'm good, man.
All right, then we out.
Peace out, guys.